Our next speaker is Professor Thad Pope. He is a law professor with Widener University, and I'm going to easily find his presentation here. Yeah, there it is. Professor Pope.
All right. Thanks. Good morning. So I'm a law professor. So this is going to be, and there's at least one other lawyer in the room. More than one? No. Okay. So I'm going to talk. My title is Advanced Directives: Legal Liability and the Good Faith Standard. So I'm going to talk about when you must honor an advanced directive and when you must not honor an advanced directive. And so this is a little elementary, but I just want to lay down very, very briefly a couple points about terminology, about what is an advance directive. So obviously it's a document that instructs providers about what medical treatment you would not want when you're unable, you lack decision-making capacity to do so yourself. And there's two sections of a Delaware advance directive. There's the appointment of agent part, also known as, or formally known as, actually, a durable power of attorney for healthcare. And in fact, the general consensus in the literature, medical literature, bioethical literature, is that this is the more important part of the advance directive. The other part of the advance directive is the instructional part, which is formally known as the living will, where you just literally put specific treatment preferences. Okay, so here, and there's an official, or quote-unquote, official Delaware form. This is just a piece of that. And this is just a piece that's the instructional part of the advance directive. It's basically sort of almost like a checkbox thing where under different conditions, under different clinical circumstances, you indicate whether you do or do not want particular interventions. This is, of course, not an exclusive form, right? You could use, well, Dr. Goodall already mentioned the Catholic form. There's a five wishes form, and there's probably at least 50 other forms that have already been specifically designed for Delaware. So, and then, of course, the other part of the advance directive, right? One half is the instructional part, the living will part. The other half is the appointment of agent part, and that's very, very simple. This is just a piece of the form developed by the Bar Association and Attorney General, which you literally just put the person's name, who you want to appoint as the agent, and their contact information. And then I think there's also space for an alternate agent in case the first agent is not, quote-unquote, reasonably available at the time that they're needed. And then, and this is not, I'm talking about this, but of course this is probably the most relevant, most frequently used provision, since most people have done neither of the previous two things I mentioned. Most people haven't left specific treatment instructions. Most people haven't appointed an agent. If you haven't done either of those two things and you don't have a court-appointed guardian, almost nobody has that, then what's left? Well, in those circumstances, then you turn to the default rules in Delaware, which just means if you haven't done anything, you haven't told us, and the court hasn't told us who you want to speak on your behalf, then we're just going to make some presumptions. And the presumptions in Delaware are, if you can't speak on your behalf, then your spouse will. If your spouse isn't available, then adult child, and just goes down in the descending order. But by volume, this is the most frequently invoked part of the Delaware Healthcare Assistance Act. Okay, so what I want to talk about before I get to the good faith section is, again, just lay one other piece of context down. And that's that there are basically three sources of legal obligations on healthcare providers with respect to advance directives. There are Joint Commission accreditation standards with respect to advance directives. There are Medicare conditions of participation with respect to advance directives. And then there's, and this is the one I'm going to talk about mostly, is the Delaware Health Care Decisions Act, state law. Okay, so with in fact, I'm not going to talk about the Joint Commission standards at all. In fact, they actually look very, very similar to the CMS conditions of participation standards, but just important, just to be complete and accurate, there are three completely separate sources of obligations. The federal law, so turning to the Medicare conditions of participation, those flow out of a law that just celebrated its 20th anniversary, the Patient Self-Determination Act, which is a federal statute passed in the wake of the Nancy Cruzan case. And this law, I mean, it's often invoked, actually wrongly, it actually provides no real, no substantive rights to patients, you know, with respect to what they may and may not do with respect to their medical care. It's completely agnostic, as federal law often is, as to the content of patient rights. What it primarily does and says is what we want you to do, Medicare dollar receiving facilities, which is Christiana and most facilities, that we want you to comply with your state law, whatever that happens to be. Whatever the patient's rights with respect to an advance directive are under your state's law, we want you to comply with that. And so you might say that, therefore, if you violate your state law with respect to advance directives, then you've also violated the Patient Self-Determination Act and the implementing regulations. And so basically, so that's the act, the Patient Self-Determination Act. That's passed by Congress. It was signed by the President. And then what Congress said there was, look, CMS, which is the agency that implements Medicare, what we want you to do is pass some regulations to implement the Patient Self-Determination Act, and they did. And those apply, even though it's a Medicare statute, those apply to all the patients in the facility, not just the Medicare patients. What these conditions of participation require, again, is primarily tell patients what their rights are under state law and honor their preferences as provided under state law. And so they've had there are these regulations and they're out there, the conditions of participation. And in fact, there's another level, if you're really interested in, you know, compliance, right, is that then CMS, of course, issues state operation manuals, which basically what they're doing is interpreting their own regulations. So in a sense, regulations issued by an agency are interpretation of the federal statute, and in turn, the agency then, for its own employees, basically interprets what its own regulations mean. So there's basically, you might say, three levels of law. There's the statute, the regulations, and then there's these sort of underground regulations. Okay, and so basically, again, the Patient Self-Determination Act has one other requirement that kind of goes a little bit beyond state law. Like I said, primary is just to comply with the state law. It also requires education. It requires education of the staff to help ensure the compliance that's required, and it also requires education of the community to help, you know, prompt reflection and to prompt them to document their wishes that follow from the reflection. And that's actually sort of what National Healthcare Decisions Day is about. Okay, so what I want to talk primarily about, though, is Delaware state law. And the Delaware Healthcare Decisions Act, which is the act which defines all the rights and obligations with respect to advance directives in the state, is all codified in Section 2500 of Title 16 of the Delaware Code, which you could Google and it would be the first hit. You can just take Delaware Code and it's nice that you can find the law that easily. So there are three basic requirements under Delaware state law. You know, notify and inform patients about their rights to complete advance directives, document the preferences that the patients have, and then respect those preferences. And I want to talk primarily about the third one, about the respecting. I'm going to loop back for a quick second. Right. So again, on admission, you know, determine if the patient has an advance directive. If they do, well, then you try to get it, and then put it in the chart and write the appropriate orders based on those preferences. If they don't have an advance directive, well, then give assistance, you know, as they may request to complete one. Give information about their right to accept and refuse treatment. And in fact, again, the Joint Commission standards and the CMS standards of participation require not just that you give the information, but that you give it in a way that's meaningful, meaning you have to take account of the patient's age, maybe their vision capabilities, literacy capabilities, language, and so forth. And then document their preferences. After admission, give them an option to review and revise the advance directive. And generally, the default rule is you have to honor the advance directive, unless there's a conscience objection, which there is under Delaware state law, or unless there's some other exception under state law. And you can't condition access. You can't force them to have an advance directive and condition care on the completion of an advance directive. Would increase the completion rate, but it's not allowed. Okay, so basically, this is my, before I move to the next point, basically, you have to respect the advance directive, right? That's basically required under the Joint Commission standards, under the conditions of participation, and probably as a matter of state discipline under the nursing board or medical board. And in fact, under common law, right, to provide treatment contrary to the patient's consent without the patient's consent would probably also constitute battery, and probably violate other common law tort negligence obligations. Okay, but there is this concept of good faith immunity with respect to advance directives. And good faith, well, we probably all have a good sense of what it means, and that's probably good enough. But this is a pretty popular definition from this case. So good faith basically just means an honest belief. You know, the absence of malice, the absence of a design to defraud or to seek an unconscionable advantage. And there's three different categories or three different types of good faith immunity provided in the Delaware Health Care Decisions Act. And they all start off like this. The healthcare, this is all just direct quotes from the statute. The healthcare provider acting in good faith, there it is not subject to civil or criminal liability or to discipline for unprofessional conduct for, and then there's a colon, then I'm going to tell you the three things that you have immunity for if you're acting in good faith. So the first is complying with an advance directive and assuming that the directive was valid when made and has not been revoked or terminated, right? So the statute uses the word assuming, right, strongly implying that you might be wrong, right? Maybe the advance directive wasn't valid when it was completed, or maybe it has been revoked. Maybe it has been terminated. But you're allowed to assume that it wasn't. In other words, you're allowed to be wrong, okay? And you still have civil immunity, criminal immunity, and disciplinary immunity. So, I mean, a simple, there's a lot of examples that would fit here, right? Real simple one is maybe there was an improper witness, right? Your witnesses can't be blood related. They're all very extensive requirements on who may not be a witness to an advance directive. Maybe there was an improper witness. How are you supposed to know who that witness was, you know, and whether or not they were or not, you know, actually not supposed to be a witness, right? This would be an example of good faith immunity, if you had no basis to know that the witness wasn't a proper witness. Second example of good faith immunity, second type of good faith immunity, and this is complying with the healthcare decision of a person apparently having authority to make a healthcare decision for a patient, including a decision to withhold or withdraw. So this is basically the parallel to the first type of provision, the first type of good faith immunity, which applies to the instructional part of the advance directive. You're applying, you know, with basically what's written on the paper. This is basically just the parallel to that, which is now you're complying with the surrogate or the agent. And again, apparently having authority. Again, using this language, the implication is that you might be wrong. Maybe they actually didn't have authority, but as far as you could tell, they had authority. And if they appeared to have authority and you followed what they said, you have immunity. And so maybe spouses, right, are at the top of the list of default surrogates, but not if they're separated or in the process of being separated. Well, maybe if nobody told you, how are you supposed to know that they are separated or being separated in the process. So, again, you know, it would be an example of somebody who apparently had authority but didn't actually have authority. It's enough that they apparently had authority. Shouldn't have followed them, shouldn't have followed their instructions, but you didn't know that you weren't supposed to follow their instructions. So then the third, this is a little bit different then, because the first two are about complying with instructions that may, if you had the full information, you shouldn't have complied with. The third type is the opposite. So this is where you have good faith immunity for declining to comply with the healthcare decision of a person based on a belief that the person then lacked authority. Okay, so here you actually don't think that they have authority and you're not going to comply with the treatment request that they're making. And where would this come up? Well, the important background point here is that surrogates must comply with certain decision-making standards. And there's a sort of hierarchical standards that they must comply with. So surrogates, if there are written instructions, right, in the advance directive, the surrogate must comply with the written instructions. Unless the patient's explicitly given permission that the surrogate is allowed to deviate from the instructions. Sometimes people might do that. They might say, I want these instructions merely to guide my agent, but I don't want them to bind, okay? If the patient said, I only want them to be guidance, then that's one thing. But unless they say that, they're binding. Okay, most people don't have written instructions, as Dr. Goodall said. So if you don't have written instructions, then the surrogate has to at least comply with the values and preferences of the patient as best as they can be determined. And then if you don't know what those are or they're not sufficiently guiding in the circumstances, then you have to move to an objective standard and make treatment decisions within the best interests of the patient. Well, what we know, and there's very, very robust evidence on this, is surrogates are not so good at this. They're very bad at predicting and knowing the patient's preferences, and their accuracy rate is barely better than chance, 60%, 62%, something like that. And the Delaware Code confirms, not just in this good faith section, but in another section of the statute, confirms that providers need only comply, quote, to the extent that the surrogate is permitted by this chapter, right? So again, if the surrogate's doing something that they really don't have authority to do, for example, contradict the express instructions in advance directive, you don't have to comply with that. In fact, as I'm going to suggest in a minute, shouldn't comply with that. It's not just permissive, it's actually sort of mandatory. Okay, so what are some examples of this? Well, real blatant example would be where your surrogate has a material conflict of interest, right? So if the surrogate has a financial conflict of interest, sometimes people confess this to their providers, right? They say, well, I'm asking for this sort of treatment because I need to keep getting this check or some reason like that. This is just a case, which is unfortunately rather common across the country, where you have parents beat children into a situation where maybe the medically appropriate, compassionate thing to do is to not sustain the child on life-sustaining medical treatment. The parent doesn't want to consent to that because if the child dies, now there's potential murder charges instead of just child abuse charges. And so clearly, the parent making that treatment decision not to disconnect a ventilator or other life support has a conflict of interest there, right? Not a good surrogate. Probably not complying with the surrogate decision-making standards we talked about. Another sort of situation is where the surrogate is contradicting the express terms of the advance directive. So there's a case, and these are all very recent cases, there's a case up in New York in Rochester where Dorothy Lovatis, she's 97 years old, and she had an advance directive and said, if I reach a state where there's really no prospect, I lack ability to interact with my environment, then I don't want to be sustained. The daughter, Iante, told the providers, no, you keep her in the ICU and you keep going. Now, Rochester thought that that was not right and not medically appropriate in any case, but here also for the additional reason that it actually contradicted the patient's advance directive. They went to court and asked for the appointment of a guardian, and the court agreed. And even though she's not just the daughter, she was the appointed agent in the advance directive, sort of a double, you know, she had decision-making authority in two separate ways. She was replaced, and there's a professional guardian. Catholic Family Health Services was appointed to be the guardian for the for Dorothy Lovatis, and then consented to withdrawing life support. There's a more recent case just from February in Minneapolis where Albert Barnes also had an advance directive. He, you know, and he reached the clinical circumstances which triggered the instructions in the advance directive. His wife, Lana Barnes, again, was requesting aggressive, curative directed treatment. And it, although this, she actually took it a step farther than in the Lovatis case, she actually altered the advance directive to disguise the fact that the treatment that she was asking for contradicted his advance directive. That's a felony. I think it's a felony in Delaware as well as in Minnesota. That was discovered, and then she also was replaced with a professional guardian. Just one last case, but it's a little bit different. Because again, most people don't have advance directives, so it's hard often to do what happened in Lovatis or in the Barnes case, because a large percentage of the population doesn't have advance directives. In this case, which was at the Mass General, Barbara Howe was the patient. Her daughter, Carol Carbett, again, was asking for continued aggressive curative directed treatment while all of the providers had reached a consensus, as well as what their ethics committee is called the Optimum Care Committee, had reached a decision that the appropriate thing to do was to move to comfort care. She wasn't consenting, right? But they don't have an advance directive this time to show that she's contradicting the express terms of advance directive. So here, it's sort of, you're operating on a best interest standard. We don't think that this is the right treatment for the patient, the treatment that the patient would have decided for herself. The Mass General went to court to basically, again, replace the surrogate. And the court didn't actually replace the surrogate, but broadcast that he was going to. He told her, your own personal issues are impacting your decisions, and I urge you to refocus your assessment. Seeing the writing on the wall from the court there, she then did consent to the recommendation of the providers at the Mass General. Okay, so that's some examples of where those providers thought, well, we can't in good faith comply with this surrogate request. But what I want to show actually that this good faith provides a pretty broad scope of protection, but there are limits to the good faith immunity. And I think perhaps the best case that illustrates this is a case, relatively recent case from the University of Southern California Hospital. Here at USC, we had a patient, Pacentia McDonald. She's 74 years old. And she had an advance directive. Actually, she was going in for surgery, so she completed the advance directive specifically in advance of this intervention. And there's obviously there's a lot more to the advance directive, but there's basically three points that I want to tell you that are the key things to know about this advance directive. First, she appointed her son, Bobby Miles, as her agent, and her daughter, Cynthia Cardoza, as the alternate agent, right, in case the primary agent is not reasonably available at the time. And then the third thing, and this is sort of a summary point, but basically the third thing is there's an instructional part of the advance directive in addition to the appointment of agent part here, and the instructional part basically said, do not prolong life if I'm in a quote-unquote incurable condition. Okay, so she goes in for a surgery on August 14, 2002 for a abdominal aneurysm, but unfortunately has serious post-operative infections. By August 30th, a couple weeks later, She has sepsis and is non-cognitive. Bobby Miles, primary agent, is regionally available. Bobby Miles requests continued life-sustaining treatment. And in fact, she has three additional surgeries. Cynthia Cardoza, the alternate agent, the sister, the daughter of the patient and the sister of the primary agent, disagrees with this. She thinks, Mom never would have wanted this. Okay? But they're not listening to her because she's only the alternate. By September 17th, so that's another couple weeks later, she threatens to sue. Okay, so she goes to the USC providers and she says, I know I'm only the alternate agent, but you should not be complying with what Bobby, my brother, is asking you to do. And in fact, once she makes the threat to sue, they do listen to her and they do stop and the patient dies pretty quickly. Okay. Cynthia still proceeds to sue, and this time for damages, basically for that extra 2 weeks, you know, of treatment that she thinks that her mother never would have wanted. That subjected her mother to additional suffering, and it subjected her, meaning her, Cynthia, the daughter, to emotional distress and so forth. So she sues for damages, LA Superior Court. USC, what do they argue? Of course, they argue good faith immunity, right? California Probate Code 4740 is exactly analogous to the Delaware Code. And it immunizes providers who act in good faith, comply with the healthcare decision made by one whom they believe to be authorized to make for the patient. Bobby was authorized. This isn't a question about Bobby was or was not the agent. They said, Bobby, here's the advance directive. It appoints Bobby. Bobby told us to do the surgeries. We got immunity, right? Goes up to the California Court of Appeals, says, don't think so, USC. And the, it is actually it's USC and the individual providers all named as separate defendants. So the California Court of Appeals said the operation of the immunity here is not so certain. Why? Compliance with an agent's decision that's at odds with the patient's own expressed decision in her advanced health care directive would probably not qualify as in good faith, right? So she had an advanced directive and said, you know, if it's incurable, I don't want it. And so Cynthia's case is basically saying you could not have complied with Bobby in good faith because Bobby is contradicting the written instructions in the advance directive. In other words, he wasn't authorized. He wasn't authorized from the patient. He didn't have authorization from the patient to ask for that kind of treatment, and you should have known that. In fact, you did know it, and therefore you couldn't have complied with him in good faith. Now, this happens all the time. I know, even here, you know, that people will comply with a surrogate even in contravention of the terms of an advance directive. Now, I think that's okay, mostly. It's usually okay. Why? Because of the probably... best example would be the thing that Dr. Goodall just mentioned. I think, what did he say? He said he had a living will that looked like an Excel spreadsheet. It was contradictory. In other words, you don't know what the hell the living will says, or the advance directive says, so it's hard to actually know whether or not the surrogate is actually contradicting the advance directive, because you don't actually know what it means. In other words, they're usually so ambiguous that you don't really often run into that kind of problem. But there's a limit to that, okay? I mean, you could take that too far. I mean, there are sometimes, I think, some limits to surrogate discretion, right? There's some line. There's a boundary lines that are reached somewhere in the advance directive. And at some point, it's pretty clear that the surrogate, in some cases, that the surrogates may have crossed those lines. Usually they're fuzzy, but there's a boundary somewhere. Now, I mentioned the Cardoza versus USC opinion for one other reason. That's because, even though it's all the way over in California, California and Delaware actually have virtually identical health care decision statutes. They were both basically enacted off of a template. Okay, so there's an entity called the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. They draft uniform laws. They drafted a lot of the laws that Delaware has, like the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, Uniform Organ Donation, Uniform Determination of Death Act, and I think even the one that you might hear about later for power of attorney. So now, each state tinkers with that and customizes it a little bit for their, but basically, since California and Delaware both basically adopted your Health Conditions Act from this template, they're very, very identical. Therefore, the California appellate court's interpretation of the language in the California statute, which is basically identical to the language of the Delaware statute, would be very persuasive to the meaning of the Delaware Health Conditions Act. And I should finish by pointing out that this, when the California Court of Appeal decided this case, the procedural posture was very early in the litigation. She had just filed the lawsuit, and when USC argued the good faith immunity, it was very, very early in the lawsuit, basically saying, well, we have good faith immunity, so get rid of this right now before we spend a lot of money. Right. And of course, what the appellate court said was, no, I don't think you have that good faith immunity. I'm going to send this back to the trial court, let the case proceed. That was in August of 2008. Okay. It went back down to LA Superior Court, and in February 2010, USC actually won. And I hesitate about whether to put this part in, because maybe undercuts my point. But I thought, for the sake of full transparency and completeness, so USC actually won. So they actually won on summary judgment back at the trial court. That's because the doctors testified that while sepsis is not uniformly fatal, and therefore she said, advanced directive, incurable condition, I didn't think it was triggered. Therefore, I didn't think the advanced directive applied. Therefore, what Bobby was asking for wasn't obvious to us, that it contradicted the advanced directive. We complied in good faith. Trial court said, sounds good to me. Summary judgment for USC. Okay, so, and that's again going to be true a lot of the time. But again, there are limits. And the other thing to remember here is that while USC got the judgment in the end, that was after 8 years of litigation, right? So, another way to state the same point is, good faith immunity under the Delaware Health Conditions Act is immunity from liability. It's not immunity from suit, right? And moreover, it's a fact question, right? It's in part a credibility question, and therefore it often needs to be resolved by a fact finder, which is the jury. So there's a way, I think, to avoid problems like this, which is, I think, one of the key ways in which the good faith immunity arises, is where you have deviant bad surrogates. And that's to educate the surrogates. There's some things about surrogates that you can't do, like they have, you know, there's lots of studies that show that they have PTSD and they have other problems, of course, because a loved one is dying. But a lot of the problems with surrogates stems from the fact that they don't really understand their role, which is put themselves into the shoes of the patient and choose what the patient would have chosen for herself. And there are, you know, educational interventions that some hospitals distribute, you know, the Guide for Healthcare Agents and Surrogate Decision Makers, Making Decisions for Patients Who Can't. The American Bar Association has a guide called Making Medical Decisions for Someone Else, a HAL-2 guide. Basically, you know, you have a new job, you know. It's like your job is now surrogate decision maker, and here's your training manual for your new job, surrogate. And so to some degree, that might help. But sometimes I think the good faith, there's limits to good faith, and so sometimes you need to replace surrogates. I'll stop there. I think we have time for questions if there are any.
What was that citation from the AEA slide?
Yeah, I don't have the, their stuff is all freely available on the ABA, it's the ABA Commission on Law and Aging, which has a lot of great resources, both for... Yeah. They actually, the ABA has a... they're very... what do? They put their materials out. They develop their materials like this one, and they also have ones that are directed to the patients, you know, for advanced care planning materials. What they allow you to do is basically republish their pamphlets and booklets customized for your state. So it could be called Making Medical Decisions for Someone Else in Delaware, a HAL-2 guide, you know, and then you could put in all the little Delaware specific parts and rebrand it, republish it. And they help you do that, actually. These are pretty good quality resources. In fact, the people who work on this are pretty much the same people that Dr. Goodall had mentioned participate in the MOLS project. So these are people who basically spend their full-time careers thinking about improving the quality of advanced care planning. Yeah.
Can the physician make a decision about what would be the appropriate care, like that interventions would not be helpful, IC would not be helpful, and make a DNI order and, you know, put him into hospice care? How is that legally? Is that acceptable, not acceptable?
Well, first, I would just note to a large degree, that question is going to be answered by Dr. McNicholas's talk later. Okay. But in terms of the scope of surrogate decision-making, generally, there's nothing in Delaware law that gives providers the right, even in the unbefriended elder, the unbefriended patient situation, which is what you're talking about, that gives the attending physician the power to step in and say, well, then I'll just make the decision myself. Nothing says that that's allowed. So I think the path in that situation is to go to the court, and if the patient has assets, then you can get a professional guardian who'll be paid out of the assets, and if they don't have assets, then you have to go to the public guardian. But you need somebody to give the consent to the treatment decision. And you can make a recommendation. So I think the recommendation is there's nothing we can do. She's catastrophically ill, and I think the right thing to do is to...
The process takes a long time, right? How long does this process take?
It takes too long. You're right. So
by the time if somebody, if you think they're going to die in a week or two...
Unless you can characterize the situation as an emergency, in which case when you go to the guardian, you say, if this is an emergency, in which case they will react appropriately to the circumstances. But unfortunately, the sort of situation that you're depicting, they may be basically stable in the sense that they're depending on a lot of stuff, dialysis and a ventilator, but there's not really an emergency because, you know, and therefore it's, you're right. Other states, it's actually something that is completely messy right now, meaning that there are states, even in the same state, that do completely different things. Sometimes the attending just does what you said, just makes a decision. Sometimes the ethics committee does it. Sometimes they go to get a guardian.
Is that legally acceptable? Is that legally correct thing to do?
I think that I don't think that's done. I think people want somebody to, we'll hear later in the presentation, maybe it'll come up. I think there's in the Delaware Healthcare Decisions Act, there's at least a reading of that act that would allow the ethics committee. That you could say that if you went to the ethics committee and said, here's my treatment plan, I think this is the appropriate treatment plan, if they agreed, then they might go ahead and write the order, even though they're really basically you'd say that the attending in combination with the ethics committee together is the surrogate decision maker. That's not clearly provided for in the statute. So I would say maybe that's done, but it's not, you're not on solid ground, I don't think. Yeah. Right. So, well, again, I don't want to jump to the other talk, but the logic here is if you had a futility policy and you're not even going to provide treatment, even if there were a surrogate, then the logic would be just because we don't have a surrogate, it wouldn't matter what the surrogate asked us to do. There's only one legitimate course to take here, and so why do we need a surrogate? Because we wouldn't. That's why I'll leave that to the other talk. I mean, I think that's...
it's more complicated to get to that point.
I still think the problem, though, is for a matter of due process, to go through the futility policy. It anticipates, first of all, the paradigm situation of the utility policy is where you actually have a surrogate on the other side asking you to do something that you think is medically inappropriate. Okay, so you don't have that, so it's not exactly your paradigm situation. The other problem is that the process has all these steps, right? The ethics committee step, and it has this other step with the CMO. The problem is, if you don't have anybody, you need, I think ideally you want somebody to be there to represent, you know, like a guardian ad litem, somebody who is basically speaking to make the patient's arguments, to look out for the patient's interests. And in the unbefriended situation, you don't have that. So I still think you'd want to get the guardian. And I agree, that's the problem, is that these patients only have a little bit of time left, usually, and the process is going to take longer than the rest of the patient's life. So it's not a very useful process. That's a big problem. It's not unique to Delaware, though. It's everywhere in the United States except Texas has that problem. All right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, to be clear, well, so if there's default surrogates, right, that start, you know, the spouse, child, but if you want to jump over that whole list, yeah, you can appoint in your advance directive. They're called agents, right? So you can appoint in your advance directive whoever you want to. And in fact, you know, up until, and I don't know what to take Tim's thunder, you know, but right, up until like maybe yesterday, one problem was there. The top of the line, it went from spouse, child, sibling. You know, the problem is if you were in a same-sex relationship, you at best going to fit in at the very bottom of the list, like eighth, which is close friend, right? And that's, you don't want them eighth. You wanted them first. But the way to bypass that whole list before yesterday was to just put them in the advance directive. So you can name whoever you want as your agent in the advance directive. No, there are. I don't have the name. I don't have the list. I mean, but there definitely are for-profit companies. There's one that's operated by nurses. And if you email me, I can look up the list of the professional guardian companies.
Yes.
And yeah, and they make money. And but I think they offer a service. Yeah. But the downside, of course, is that those people don't know you, right? They don't know your values. They don't have the, like a family member actually cares about you and hopefully would be motivated by, both by having more knowledge about you and by caring about you more than the professional guardian. So generally, family members, on average, make better guardians than professional guardians. But you're right. There could be situations where they might be better. Thank you.